Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. We haven't talked about them for, I think a whole 4 weeks, but it's time to turn back to Syria. Things have developed further. Where do things stand right now, Jim?
Well, the Syrian government, a few weeks ago, of course, there was a bombing at a meeting of the senior leadership, not Bashar Assad himself, but his brother-in-law and defense minister, senior people. Four people died. And Bashar Assad has not been heard from since. In the meantime, the city of Aleppo in the north of the country, Damascus is down south, closer to the Israeli border, 2.5 million people, the rebels invaded. And that started, I think, on the 19th, not long after the bombing. And it's been going on ever since. Every few days, the government says they've defeated the rebels, and the next day, the rebels pop up in another neighborhood. The problem is, it's not a conventional, you know, battle for a city between two armies. The rebels have the advantage in that many of the neighborhoods in Aleppo are full of people who back the revolution. These are civilians who basically keep their heads down, but if a rebel fighter comes by, you know, they'll hide them, they'll feed them, they'll show them the easiest way to get to another neighborhood without being detected by the army patrols. That's invaluable. And this has basically kept the rebellion going. The casualty level is apparently fairly low. I mean, by major war standards, a couple of hundred casualties a day, you know, killed and wounded. Most of them apparently civilians because the major weapon the Syrian army, the government is using is artillery. And this is simply, this is hurting them because it's basically not only turning more civilians against the government, I mean, there are a lot of civilians who just want to stay out of this. I mean, again, people have to live. And when they sense that the government doesn't care if they live or die and is using artillery in a reckless fashion, they seek a solution and they are the rebels. So all this artillery fire, and sometimes the government forces have fired up to 8 hours, you know, thousands of shells on our neighborhood before they send the ground troops in. And, of course, by the time the ground troops get there, the rebels are gone. And that's how the thing keeps going because there's only a few thousand rebels. And the government's not killing many of them or even wounding many of them. And when they do, these guys just become another local civilian who got hurt by the bombing because the civilians he's among are not going to turn him in. Oh, this is my cousin Fassad. Yo, yeah, he's from, you know, Holmes or whatever. The government is losing. I mean, it's a perception battle. They have to hang on to Aleppo. But as long as the rebels keep popping up, and as long as the government keeps firing their artillery at one neighborhood after another, again, these are not neighborhoods, in most cases, full of people who normally support the government, you know, the minorities, especially the Alawites, Christians or other sects. They are basically Sunnis, who are 75% of the population and majority in Aleppo. So the government is simply digging itself into a deeper hole. And simply stopping and declaring victory every few days. But the direction, you know, is pretty obvious. They're not going to win, and people are running out of food. Stuff isn't getting into the country. Turkey has shut their borders to commercial traffic, meaning supplies for the government. Foreign aid groups are allowed to send in supplies, although this is problematic because the government forces will steal these food supplies as quickly as anyone else who can get their hands on them. The people are suffering, but they always do in a war. And it's a question of how long the government can maintain a force because there have been reports of troops involved in the Aleppo fighting simply deserting under fire. You know, armored vehicles just rolling off, you know, a platoon of three or four armored vehicles. going. It turns out they're deserting. The armed forces have been falling apart, you know, especially for the last 6 or 8 months. Many army units are basically prisoners in their own, bases, with, you know, the loyal troops being the only ones allowed to carry weapons. It's basically all falling apart. It's not a question of, you know, if the Bashar Assad government is going to fall, but when.
Austin?
Hey. Hi. Jim, I think, summarized it rather well. We've got ourselves a full-fledged war here, Dan. We actually have for quite some time. The one reason that's, that we can say it with confidence now is that Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, has just resigned his job as the official peace envoy from the United Nations and Arab League for Syria. And I looked at briefly at just before we did the podcast at a statement by Mr. Annan, and I was not impressed with his mission, Dan. We've talked about it on Strategy Talk before. I thought his peace plan was pie in the sky because he had no teeth with which to enforce it. And basically, in extremely diplomatic language, his resignation statement to the press recognizes those flaws. Here, I've got it right here in front of me. One sentence that caught my eye. This is Kofi Annan. It is impossible for me or anyone to compel the Syrian government and also the opposition to take the steps to bring about the political process. As an envoy, I can't want peace more than the protagonists, more than the Security Council or the international community. That's what he said. Well, this is a war, and there's a fight going on by either side, by both sides. I think at this point the rebels believe the tide is in their favor. It wasn't always so, but we've seen the weakening, the defections that Jim mentioned. I think if somebody was writing a popular history, they would point to the bomb attack that we that Jim mentioned, and we've mentioned in a previous discussion that killed several senior members of the Syrian government as a quote unquote tipping point. No, I think that the tipping point was sometime late last summer when the tip was that it was clear that Turkey was more or less the front line of NATO, and that it was a conflict that became a NATO-Iranian shadow war being played out in Syria. And when I say the tipping point with that is that the rebels were, if not receiving aid directly from Turkey, as Jim's pointed out in previous podcasts, the aid that the rebels have been getting seems to be coming from the Persian Gulf, Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar get mentioned. But there was the fact that the morale, the moral support that Turkey and NATO were providing, that was a major political boost to the fractionalized rebels. We have Turkey, and behind Turkey, NATO, it's there. It's not moving forward. It's trying to use the United Nations. But to get back to the United Nations Arab League plan and Kofi Annan, is that when they come in and say, no, just stop shooting at each other, and they didn't have any enforcement mechanism. The Alawites and the Assad government, and I'm using the Alawites as that's the ethnic group, religious ethnic group that the Assad's belong to, and they're the strongest supporters of the regime, see that they face a deluge, they face destruction. They have a lot of revenge seekers if they lose, and they're not going to quit, and they've been all the ceasefires that Annan claimed that he was brokering, and not a single one of them, actually, I don't even think they were recognized, except briefly for television cameras in a couple of cities. And you also had the infighting in the Security Council. Well, that's code word for saying China and Russia wouldn't support U.S. And British proposals to find a really put together a peace-promoting operation. So I think that it now plays out in the streets with gunfire, more bombs, and it's we're approaching a place, and I'm not going to try to give you a definite date on it, but where I think you'll see more large-scale efforts by the rebels. And I think they're getting arms, they're getting training. They see the government starting to break. Some of it will be attacks to get headlines on their part. I'm not going to speculate as to what Assad might do. I don't see him pulling a Gaddafi and trying to slip out and fight it out with a bunch of bodyguards. I see him and him going into exile. But that's certainly a change from past strategy talks, isn't it, there?
Yeah, it is.
There's been a move here, and now it's and what I'm doing is putting kind of a paragraph summary on all the elements that Jim brought up that are going on. There's so many little threads are fraying on behalf of the Assad regime.
Now, where would they go for asylum?
Well, that's a good question, and a fair question to ask, and I do not know. I don't think the Iranians want to be so overt as to offer him asylum, realize that he is an Arab. They may be able to broker a deal with some other Arab government to take him and remove him and his family from power. I mean, that's speculation there. It's conceivable. You could see, and I'm just pulling this out because I know that that Asma al-Assad, Bashir's wife, has a, as I understand, a residence in Great Britain. You might see a temporary kind of deal there. If you'll flee, we'll let you stay here temporarily until you find some permanent place. So that's speculation there.
Is France a possibility?
France could be a possibility. Yes,
I know that's where a lot of ex-dictators have
gone. Yes, they do.
That used to be a safe haven, but now that you've got such a prominent war crimes tribunal, there are far fewer places to go. Another problem with Assad is Syria has been a pawn, as it were, of Iran, Shia Iran, since the 1980s. And there have been a lot of stories, some of which will be substantiated, coming out of Syria recently about Iran sending in some of its counterterrorism specialists to try and put down the rebellion. This does not go down well with most Arab countries because at the moment the Iranians are making noises that they should be the guardian of the holy places of Islam in Saudi Arabia, you know, not the al-Saud family. And Shia Islam should be the premier flavor of Islam, not Sunni. Currently 80% or so of Muslims are Sunni. And of course there's the thousands of years of animosity between the Iranians who are Indo-European and the Arabs who are Semites. There's no love lost between the two groups, and for this reason, Iraq, despite having a Shia majority, is still pretty anti-Iran. Partly because they don't want to become a religious dictatorship like Iran has been for the last 30 years. They know, the Iraqis know, especially now that the Saddam has gone and the borders fairly open, they know what's going on over there. And the majority of Iraqis want no part of it. So Iran, Iran could be a last choice, as it were, as an exile. But none of the, shall we say, civilized nations. You know, nations that basically obey their international agreements and what have you, are going to, accept Assad or any other of the senior people from the his government. So they are pretty much stuck. Russia might take them because Russia's making itself into a loud and proud outlaw nation. And they still back Assad, although they're making noises now that, well, we don't back him as much. And one day they say, yeah, we take him as an exile, and next day they say no. But basically, he hasn't got a lot of options. He used to have France as an option. There used to be a lot of Western countries that, were willing to take an out-of-work dictator, especially if he brought most of his country's treasury with him. But that's pretty much gone, especially since the Cold War ended. Times are tough, especially for those trying to negotiate an end to the war in Syria, because I think Austin's pointed this out before. You can't really do that anymore because the international war crimes crew are not willing to make deals, or they're very reluctant to make deals to let anybody off the hook. And this basically makes it a death match, not a negotiation.
Yeah. Well, maybe he could get some nice beachfront property in North Korea.
Or Devil's Island.
And notice I prefaced that Iran was the first country I mentioned. I said I didn't think it would be so overt, but I do like the way that Jim says it. It is the last resort.
But there's no other choice, especially if North Korea is in the running. Actually, we should do a segment on North Korea pretty soon. There's some interesting things going on there. Be that as it may, North Korea is not a place to be in exile. Iran is not too bad. I mean, there are parts of Iran which are up to a Western standard in terms of lifestyle. There's a fairly large middle class there. You do have to worry about the religious police, which would come as a shock, to the largely secular, ruling classes in Syria. But at least you'd still be alive, which may not be, the case much longer if they stay in Syria.
Right.
You know, that is another way, Dan, of approaching what I was saying about I'm not picking the moment, but we're seeing this roll into a phase where of deterioration of the regime. An example of it is just as Jim said, that the Russians who have been backing them saying, well, we don't back them as much, Well, they've done that jig in Moscow a couple of times already, but the losses of senior government officials, defections among in the army, and the increasing capabilities of rebel guerrilla bands, I'm not going to call them units, but rebel guerrilla bands because of the availability of better quality weapons, ammunition, also the appearance of what look like safe zones within Syria. I've seen some evidence really over the past couple of weeks, Dan, of where you'll see pictures of rebels having dinner together and the like. So this is, you know, look at it as propaganda pictures as well. But there are places that the government has not been able to they have not been able to assert control, and the rebels essentially have formed small base areas, and that's a sign of losing. Doesn't mean that you will lose, but it's a sign of gathering increasing strength of the power of resistance.
Yeah, boy, it's interesting how these huge caches of weapons and munitions have ended up being a two-edged sword for these leaders.
Well, that's always been the case. It's something that they, I think, accepted on the advice of their longtime Russian advisors, back in the old Soviet days. Because when the Soviets invented the modern police state, early in about a century ago, they basically came up with the idea of lots and lots of small arms and other weapons in case they were invaded. They could mobilize the people and arm them. at least to repel the invader. And that actually worked in World War II. And after that, they basically manufactured all these weapons, which after the Cold War ended up in Africa and other places. It accounted for millions of deaths in Africa because their weapons were promptly stolen and put on the black market and what have you. I think there was in a movie called, Nicolas Cage was in it. Anyway, I think it blamed the CIA. But anyway, CIA had nothing to do with it. And the same is the case now in many Arab countries where, that are dictatorships. They have these huge stocks of weapons and they find that they don't have to worry about an invasion as much as they have to worry about an internal rebellion. And at that point, you're not going to give away weapons to anyone, but people are capturing them. That's something else we didn't mention earlier. The fighting inside Aleppo has been particularly embarrassing because the rebels have captured several military bases. There's a lot of military bases in Aleppo. And there's been a lot of looting of weapons, including tanks and other armored vehicles, which is very bad for government, for the regular troops, for their morale, because they never know when they see another tank pointing their gun at them that that's just one of their own, happens to be passing by with the gun facing that direction, or they're about to be blown apart by a rebel or a controlled tank. So all these, this lust is basically backfiring, and it always will, and I don't know if anybody's going to rethink that and get rid of their huge stockpiles. That doesn't seem to be happening, so I guess we can be grateful for that.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, that looks like a pretty good place to finish this one. Let's see what happens over the next month or so, because we'll be coming back to Syria once again.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it winds down. But I think for now we can say Assad is probably going to be on the run someplace.
Good business.
Yep.
All right.
We'll talk to you next time.
Bye, guys.
Bye.